head into the theater and the usher nods me in. They know me here. I descend down the staircase behind the movie screen that only select people know about. The door at the bottom opens and I walk in. The sound of movie spoilers fill the air. The barkeep has my drink ready and motions me to the back. The rest of the crew are here already. This is my type of place and these are my type of people. Join me as we discuss the inner secrets of cinema. Have a seat in the spoiler room.
Yes, folks, we are back with more superhero fun on June, which has become our superhero month here in the spoiler room. And man, have I got one. I tell you, I don't remember a movie where I had so many crew members volunteering to want to talk about a film. So many, in fact, unfortunately, we couldn't have them all in the room tonight, but we do have quite a bountiful choice of crew members for you to listen to tonight. First off, he is back in the spoiler room. It is Mr. Cole Meredith. Hello, Cole. How are you?
I am fantastic, sir. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, I had heard from a little bird, or, you know, we've talked in the past that you might just like The Crow. So, you know, I figured when this came up as a movie to talk about that you might just want to be on the show. Not quite sure if you enjoy it, but... And next to Cole, the BFD himself, spoiler room regular, it's Mr. Glenn Bittner. Hello, Glenn. How are you?
Yes.
Yes. Glenn is ready to talk The Crow, I'm sure. Or better than eating crow. So there you go. I eat crow. But anyway.
with a nice little panko breadcrumb and... Yeah. And yeah, they fry up good.
Man, and anything tastes good with panko breadcrumbs. So, you know, if I ever am poor and have to eat shoes, I'm going to make sure I have enough money to buy panko breadcrumbs because that makes anything taste good. Next to Glenn, we have him returning. Yes, it is the exclusive composer for Special Mark Productions, musician, good friend. He is back. Mark, yes, the same man with the same name as myself, Mark Woldridge, is here. Hello, Mark. Welcome back to the spoiler room.
Good evening. It'll be confusing, but it'll be worth the fun here to have the double dose of Mark here going on.
That's right, folks. You're getting a double dose of Mark tonight.
Oh, yeah.
Double the pleasure, double the fun.
Come here.
Double mint sugar-free gum. Anyway, and next to Mark, it's the bowtie man himself, Mr. Paul Salzer. Hello, Paul. How are you?
I'm doing well, but now much better now that I know that there's two marks in the room.
There are two marks. And where your little icon is on my Google Hangout, you are in a Mark sandwich. So you've got a mark on both ends.
Yes.
Wait, where'd Paul go? Suddenly he left the room. He's trying to reorder the icons. No! Yes, tonight, folks. We are playing it a little loose, but it is 1994's The Crow. Now, let's see, which one of you would like to give the summary of The Crow? Let's go with Glenn. Glenn, would you like to give a short synopsis of The Crow?
Sure.
Could you, please?
Oh, yeah, I can do that.
Now I feel like I'm talking about kids. They do that exact same thing.
So... Bruce Lee's kid loves this woman. People don't like him. They kill him. She's all sad. He comes back from the dead, kills all of them.
There you go. Yeah. It is a comic book film, superhero of sorts, if you will, based off of the graphic novel, the same name, the graphic novel written by James O'Barr. This one has the screenplay written by David Shaw. And folks... Yeah, this one, you're going to hear a lot of stuff about this film tonight, probably a lot of gushing about it, but we're going to first just do like we always do and get initial people's feelings of when they first saw this film. And Mark, we're going to start with you as you haven't been here for a while.
Well, all right. Well, I saw the movie before I saw the graphic novel, and I'm not exactly sure what it was about it, but it made something of an impression on me at that point, and I saw it in the theater, I think, 18 times that summer. It was, yeah, in the theater 18 times. And it's just sort of been a continuing presence. We're going to be talking about the soundtrack later on, both regular and the orchestral score. I have, shall we say, borrowed from that score for different elements. It's it's just between the thinking this story and the companion graphic novel. And I know the graphic novel was first, but comparing and contrasting between the two, it's always just something that's been always sort of with me in that way. So, yeah, it's just near and dear to me in that way.
Nice. Nice. Great to hear. And Glenn, how about you? First time you saw The Crow?
Oh, man, The Crow. Well, I've been a fan of the comic. And I think they did a pretty decent job bringing the comic to life. I think Brandon Lee was a great choice as Eric Draven. Just it's a fun movie. I think it's underrated. Partly because this is back in the day when there weren't many comic book movies that were made about non-superhero type people.
Yeah.
And even that, there weren't that many comic book movies, period, that weren't just Superman. Superman or Batman, and that was pretty much the bulk of it, unless, you know, it was something done by, oh my God, why am I blanking on the guy who did the original Avengers? The horrible one. No. God, what's his name? The cheap movie guy who's done Corman? Like 18 Bill Corman.
Corman?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Okay, Roger.
With exception of him, Roger Corman. God, why could I? Could not remember his name.
Yeah. Gotcha.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Cole, how about you? First time you saw The Crow?
When I was first taken to the theater to see this, I was more looking forward to Beverly Hills Cop 3, believe it or not. Beverly Hills Cop was my favorite movie of all time at that point, sort of tied with The Breakfast Club. And my parents, well, my father and my stepmother, for some reason, wanted to go to The Crow, probably because it was a little edgier and darker, yada, yada, yada. And in fact, right before I walked into the theater, I went to, what music stores existed in the malls at that time?
Sam Goody.
Probably Sam Goody.
It was probably a Sam Goody.
Yes, sir. And I bought the Beverly Hills Cop 3 soundtrack, which was right next to The Crow soundtrack. You know, and took that home with me. But I'll tell you, man, I sat there. I liked Rapid Fire and I liked Enter the Dragon, but I'm not what you would call a hardcore, like, Bruce Lee fanatic. I am now. But back then, in 1994, I was 15, 16, something like that. I'm not what you would call, I'm going to sit down and watch this movie and just praise it. I sat down and watched that movie and it changed my fucking life. I mean, it kind of showed me what cinema could be as art, as an art form. In fact, on the way home, like, we pulled into a Burger King on our way out of the movie and everybody's just, my stepmom's complaining about, the strobe lighting. my biological father is talking about, oh my God, if he just lived longer, they would have given him a budget. And they handed me, what do they have at Burger King? I think it's Whoppers.
Yeah.
They handed me a Whopper and I got two bites into it. And this is true. And I just started weeping because this movie really hit me. I mean, it hit me deep in my bones. It's like the notion of violence being in strict juxtaposition with a love story and uncompromisingly so, was something I had never seen in an action film, quote unquote, action film. You know, maybe my reaction was, you know, sort of predisposed. I was expecting a kung fu movie, which I didn't get, but it was scene by scene. It seems to be contrasting the violence of life with perhaps the best things that life can offer. And it does that for an hour and 40, an hour and 15 minutes. And by the end of it, you're just exhausted. And I appreciated it for that. I had never seen anything like that at that point in my life. Now, obviously, you know, if I had been at film school or I had seen Blade Runner, you know, I would have understood more that, you know, it's not entirely original. It's just kind of building on things that have already been done. Mm-hmm. But at that point, there was no Netflix. All you could get was, if you didn't have HBO or Skinamax, all that you could watch was at the local VHS store, you know? And the local VHS store didn't have Blade Runner. So The Crow hit me deep and hard, man. And it really, just watching it again tonight, right before I came on, I'd never seen it on Blu-ray, or at least I don't remember seeing it on Blu-ray. Holy shit. This is a damn near perfect film. and that's all I have to say for now.
And it's superhero month. I call it superhero month because this is based off a comic book, though, you know, and I guess he could be considered a superhero, but yeah, you are, especially for the time it came out. I will say it's solid. It is a very solid film. Paul, how about you? First time you saw The Crow, do you remember?
Yeah, I do. The first time I watched it, my roommate at the time was a big a fan of Obar, so he already prepped me for the film, so I was really ready for it. And it was a very impactful film for me, and it was a very formative film for me growing up, because I've watched it over the years. But the last time that I watched the film was probably the most impactful for me, and it was at the time that I had probably one of my worst breakups. And the line that Sarah says with the voiceover that, you know, buildings burn, people die, and love is forever.
Mm-hmm.
When you're breaking up, that is an amazing line that I couldn't tell you how much I felt. And the fact that a movie, a single line in a movie, could draw out so many feelings with just the one line tells you the power of this film.
Yeah, the story is a hell of a lot stronger than you might expect from a guy from back from the dead vigilante story. There's some depth of character here, not just with our hero, but with our villain. I remember seeing it, you know, 94. I was out of high school, in college. It was May of 94. I don't remember offhand if I saw it up. I think I saw it up here at Rogers Cinema first. I saw it a few times. And I loved it because I was a big Batman fan anyway. You know, Batman and Batman Returns had hit the screen at that point. So I was looking for darker comic book movies, darker superhero movies. And here comes along one that at the time I wasn't familiar with the source material at all. But I just remember it had Brandon Lee, and I saw the trailer, and I'm like, okay, dude, I'm in. This is dude dressed up in black with a crow kicking a bunch of people's ass. I will go see this film. And yeah, I loved it. I've watched it many times. Didn't have to revisit it for the show, but I did anyway, just because I watched it going, you know, I have pretty much this whole movie memorized because I've mm-hmm. watched it many, many times. But one of the things I've noticed, and I want to get Paul's opinion first, and we'll go down the line here. We do have a large crew, so we'll have to play it a little bit differently. But one of the things I did notice about certain, I always consider there's certain films out there that are kind of milestone films, not just for you, but for like cinema in general or whatnot. You know, you had like Die Hard, you had like Batman, and The Crow. If there is any action comic book movie that epitomizes and encapsulates everything going on in the subculture and pop culture of the 90s.
And that's pretty much it was all contained within Sarah's outfit, pretty much.
It was the crow. Paul, would you agree this thing pretty much, I mean, if you want to know what the 90s subculture was like, Paul, would you say it's the crow?
Oh, yeah. I agree with just the mentality, the thoughts of it. And for me, this kind of helped me with my feelings for goth culture. Because it gave me kind of that emo type of experience the first time I got to experience that type of thing. And the music plays a huge role. And I think having a good mix of the score plus modern music with modern musicians at the time, that it helped. And it wasn't pop music either. It was stuff that, you know, like Stone Temple Pilots, you had The Cure, you know, and you had Nine Inch Nails, and those are the guys that like it. This film is very good for that time period, and it's a great film for that reason. So,
yeah, I'm glad you brought up the music. We'll talk about that in a little bit. Mark, wouldn't you say though this encapsulates the 90s? I mean, what a time for the goth scene. The year before, you had Nightmare Before Christmas, and then you had this film followed up the next year. I mean,
I find it funny a little bit. You're thinking about how The Matrix took all of the leather and sort of stylized it and went through the whole sci-fi sort of thing. Like, this was the whole gritty, urban, ugly. It was just missing vampires, pretty much, as far as that went. As far as the whole goth sort of thing going on. Oh yeah, it was. It was the complete package between the costuming and the music and the setting and the overall. It's surprising in that it's a very dark movie, but you doesn't dark shot. I'm thinking right. about as far as the cinematography of it. It never feels like what's going on. I'm trying to see this because sometimes the darkness can overtake the entire shot. But there's enough contrasting in color and the fire and light and everything that, yeah, it's a good collection of contrasts and encapsulation of when it came out.
So basically, yeah. just add Wesley Snipes and you have Blade?
Yes.
Pretty much, which came out that same decade, another comic book movie that came out that decade of the 90s after the Batman period. And yeah, it encapsulates so much. And watching this, I'm like, wow, from the music to the themes, to the story themes. Now, Glenn, you mentioned you were a huge fan of The Crow. Did they at least touch on or at least hold in the spirit of the comic as far as some of the themes that run through the film?
Sort of.
yeah, sort of. I mean, you at least get, you know, a little bit. I mean. Mm-hmm.
See, I'm curious. I went in not knowing the source material at all. And I do think that if I had went in knowing the graphic novel before I saw the movie, I might have been ticked off.
Oh, that, I was going to bring that up.
Yeah, because
in this day and age, if this movie was released in this day and age, people would be crying wolf.
Yeah.
I mean, this is not a faithful adaptation to the graphic novel by any means.
No, because it's like the way I've always sort of contrasted the two is the movie is, will Eric succeed in his mission? And in the graphic novel, it's, he's going to succeed. He's a force of nature. He's going
to
succeed.
Well, it might just be happening in his head.
That too. It's like, yeah, it's the element of, will he maintain his sanity for the end of it? That is the story of the graphic novel.
Yeah.
And which might not translate as well to a movie. I understand why they did what they did. But I could also see being maybe a little irritated that they didn't go with that path.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Were you irritated, Glenn?
not really that much. Mm-hmm. I have long ago accepted that movies are not going to be faithful to the book materials that they come from.
Mm-hmm.
And it depends. To me, it depends is, do they have a basic premise from the book? And how far do they... I mean, yes, this you have a lot of things that that vary, but I still think they capture a lot of the feel of the comic.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, yeah, there are definitely things that, you know, they definitely change some things. It's been a while since I've read the comic, probably close to 10 years or more, but things I'm trying to remember is I remember, well, I know his girlfriend was Sarah.
Right.
And it wasn't so much that they were like a long time thing. If I remember right, she just kind of, he met her, I'm trying to remember now. It's been too long.
Mm-hmm.
I know.
I'll send you a copy, Glenn.
I have.
I will. Oh, okay.
I have it. I just haven't read it in a long time.
Roger.
Because I would say that they got the love story right. They got that element.
Yeah.
There. One of the things that they did in the graphic novel was that the crime, the actual murder that kicks off the entire thing, was completely random. There was no crime syndicate or anything like that. No. It was just a chance event.
Yeah, wrong place, wrong time.
Yeah, and that was something that was scuttled for the movie.
Which is typical. They did it with the Punisher. You know, they kind of always need to add some rhyme or reason to the murder.
Well, but I think that goes along, though. The reason they do that is because you've only got so much time to tell your story within the movie, whereas with the comic, you could explore more things because you're not planning on it being a one-issue run. You know what I mean?
Roger, yeah.
You know, so you could get away with just having it as a random encounter and then exploring that and how that affects him and him going out, whereas in a movie, you've only got so much time. You hear that, Marvel? You can create a movie that's good and short, but you still only have so much time to tell your story.
The one thing that did bother me is where's Skull Cowboy?
Skull Cowboy?
Oh.
See, if you haven't read the comic, you don't know who Skull Cowboy is.
No, I don't.
Skull Cowboy basically provided guidance to Eric throughout the comic.
Ah, okay.
Well, considering that also the crow talked in the book as well. So,
and Glenn, I will send you. Well, if I can find it, I will send you the work print. The Skull Cowboy is in it.
Oh yeah. They cut him out of the final.
Right. Yeah, they did. They cut him out of the final.
Oh yeah. No, I haven't seen any actual scenes. I've seen pictures of.
Oh,
of
Roger! I wasn't trying like to that. Be condescending.
Oh no! Yeah.
Literally, like, I'll send you the work print, brother. I mean, he was in it. It's just, it was like, fuck, man. Brandon hadn't shot most of his dialogue with that character, and it was also like, I don't know. It was too supernatural. So I mean, they just cut it out for just because it was easier to get the movie finished, but. That character's in it. Who's Michael Berryman? The Hills From Eyes guy was the Skull Cowboy.
Man. I would have loved to see him in that.
So. Yeah, he was the Skull Cowboy, right? Am I mistaken? I think he was.
Wow. But. That would have been cool to see. Though they do have a lot of cool villains in here who were actually introduced to them in this T-Birds gang. But before that, I want to talk real quick. I like I said, there's so many things you can mention about this film. I want to say, for a film that was shot on like $23 million, I was impressed how well, even to this day, this opening shot is, where they go over a miniature. You're following a crow. You go over this miniature, and they come up on the house, and it blends into a live-action scene with Ernie Hudson, who plays the cop in this. Paul, what'd you think of the special effects in this?
I thought it was well done. I thought that they didn't go overboard with it, especially, you know, what I wanted to mention was the fact that one of the things I thought that translated really well was the feel and the look of it. The comic books that I remember my roommate having were basically these black and whites, lots of black and some white in there. So when I got to watch the film and having it so dark, I was actually happy for that because it made me think that they really did look at the pages and they translated well. And I think that whole mentality went from visual designs to special effects. They tried to keep it grounded, of all things. You know what I mean? it's pretty good because of this kind of source material of death. And to have that groundedness is kind of an added theme to the story. So, is there a specific scene that you want me to talk about?
No, just this opening scene. I thought was impressive, even for this day, how they blended the miniature with the live action, where they come up on the crashed glass, and you got Ernie Hudson looking down. And
I was glad that they did that kind of opening shot because one of the things that you kind of see in the comic books are these kind of like city things in the background, so you can kind of see depth in there. So it was nice that they opened the film that way too, because it kind of showed that view, and you also got to see like the kind of like a crow flying over certain things, and I liked that, and it just everything it's very like Poe-esque, where you know everything has a purpose, and they, you know, even the simplest littlest things are put in there for a reason. And so it's one of those films that you can constantly watch and learn something new every time.
Like with the little details, I know Brandon Lee was very deeply into the source material. You can see things that he is doing over the course of the movie that are from the graphic novel, but they aren't mentioned in the movie. Like when the electrical tape shows up on his forearms or that he has the bullets tied into his hair. That's explained in the graphic novel, and it shows up in the movie, but it's never explained. Those little details are there, and like you're talking about, it grounds the entire thing.
But this movie in general, I think that's maybe too why they don't have so much more supernatural. I mean, they established that he has a power, you know, and he came back from the dead, so you got a little bit of supernatural stuff going on, but it's not overly burdened, especially not as much as when you get to that sequel called City of Angels, which we... aren't acknowledging at all. I've heard about, but yeah. but the special effects in general, I think there's only a couple shots in here that I think don't hold up very well. But overall, I dug the special effects and the production design. Glenn, what about you and the look of this film as far as production design, costuming, and especially the special effects in here?
I mean... Looking at it now, I mean, some of it is a little dated, effects-wise and stuff. But I like the overall, the dark, you know, feel of it and everything like that. I think they captured that part, from what I remember, the comic pretty well. Just, you know, the I mean, it's not that hard to make something dark and broody. Especially in the 90s. I mean... I think they had pills you could just take, like boom, boom. It's like you're now in Nirvana. But I mean, I do like the overall look of it. I mean, it's well done, I think. But though, like I said, some of the effect stuff is a little dated. But no, I don't think it's enough to take you really out of the movie. Like you're gonna watch it and go, oh, that's so fake. I mean, someone who's 14 might, but.
I think that's one of the benefits of actually having used the miniatures. CGI from that era did not age as well. Using miniatures are timeless in that way. I think it makes it survive and transcend a little bit better than it otherwise would have.
Yeah, the miniatures definitely do help. I think the only shots that don't quite work are a few of the shots where he's running on the roof. But other than that, even the parts where his wounds are sealing up, I think for mid 90s, look pretty damn good.
Well, part of it for the ones where he's running on the roof, weren't those done after he had died? I believe that some of those were done with a body double and a mask. Well, and that was part of the reasoning for that. Some of it was not necessarily great effects, but some of them I think were done post-production that way.
According to Ibibidim, anyway, they had there were four scenes where they didn't shoot. They hadn't shot yet that before. Brandon Lee unfortunately passed away. The go figure, the origin setup of him putting his costume on and the makeup, they had not shot yet. So they actually shot it with a body double and they CGI'd, which for 94, you look at this scene where he's looking in the mirror through the fractured glass and you tell me that's CGI because that looks pretty damn good. Yeah. But that's CGI'd. You can tell definitely when he's walking and you get the epic shot of the crow landing on his shoulder and he's standing in the shattered window that we mentioned earlier, because Eric Draven came back to life a year after he was killed. So his apartment's all run down and, the windows.
T-Bird's entire death, obviously, Brandon isn't there. That's they took shots of Brandon from Gideon's scene. And sort of stuck them in there. There's actually a fourth of Draven's scenes are not Brandon. And I don't mean to say this as a diminishing thing, but it is true. I mean, if you listen to Proyas's commentary, he says, man, my biggest regret is I couldn't build the love story, which I think comes through, but they don't think it. You know, the filmmakers feel like they didn't want quick, glimpses of the relationship. They wanted like the comic to be like long extended scenes where you would get into these people and they just had to like cut it all up. But yeah, man, there's actually a lot of scenes that Brandon was meant to be in that he's just not in. It's actually kind of sad when you watch the film overall and you kind of, I've seen it 115 times, 116 times, you begin to realize that it's not just little blips. They literally kind of reinvented the notion of CGI. I mean, this movie might have been the first movie to really use CGI to replace an actor's face. It's pretty interesting. You know, when that lightning hits and you see Brandon's face as it pans back, that's a revolutionary shot to me, because had that ever been done before?
Not that I'm too aware of in films that had really been done to try to replace the actor. They usually used creative camera work in that, but as far as overlaying the face, I remember them talking about it too, that it was one of the first times they were trying that. And for one of the first times, it does work well. I mean, that one doesn't quite hold up, but the shattered window scene, the mirror scene, I think looked particularly good and they sold it well. One of the big things that always surprises me, and even watching it again, now that we have this clout of comic book movies, one of the things that surprises me with The Crow, that it's under 2 hours, it's an hour and 42 minutes, and we actually have not just our hero, but the other characters in this film all have some depth to them. They aren't just there to help the superhero or whatnot and move along. Cole, would you agree? I mean, even our villain and even the side characters, they all seem to have some depth to them rather than just being the cliche.
Absolutely. Every character is perfectly created. I mean, every character has a perfect amount of depth, even right down to the fired up scheme. which starts off with they're like, they're doing bullets right before they do shots, which is horrifying.
Swallowing bullets. I don't get that one, but
I can't even eat a block of cheese. Can you imagine eating a bullet? Fuck. it slowly whittles down to Skank, who is just wandering in a circle going fired up. I think every character is given just the right amount. This film is goddamn nearly perfect. You know, there are moments where I go through where I think, okay, this is just, I was 15 and I loved it because I was 15. And then I watch it again and I realize, no, this movie is actually a masterpiece. It really is. And my fiance bought the Blu-ray for me for this show this evening. The characterizations in this movie are perfect. Everybody is given just the right amount of time to function as a character. I don't know if that's answering your question.
No, but, it does, yeah.
If you're referring to the villain specifically, Jesus Christ, I mean, they're perfect. T-Bird opens with his quote about Lake Erie.
Yeah.
Which is just environmental enough to not be gaggy, you know? it's right on that notion. It's right on that line of you can relate to it, but it's not science fiction. And, you know, it's just relatable enough. And, I've said too much already. Let somebody else go on. I'm sorry. I could talk about
this movie. You know, thinking about the band of villains in this movie, it's – they're cartoony without being cartoonish. They're fun caricatures in a way. And one thing I like to sort of compare them with is I think of another Detroit sort of movie, RoboCop.
Yes.
And the band of villains in that movie, where they all had their characterizations and their quirks and everything like that. And that's one of the things that holds that movie together so well is that they were all such unique and horrifying villains. And I think The Crow has that going for it as well, in that each member of this crew here, they're horrible people and they're fascinating to watch.
Well, not only fascinating, they don't feel like they're the same guy. I know I'm having get off my lawn moments, deal with it, folks. Nowadays you watch a lot of the films and a lot of the, you know, sub villains or whatnot, if you call it, they all kind of feel the same. Even when you get your gang of villains, you only have one leader and the rest of them are all just foot soldier guys.
Generic henchmen. Yeah.
And in this one, each one of these Motor City motherfuckers, is unique, and you can tell there's at least a little bit of history, and we spend at least more time than you would expect with them, considering the movie is called The Crow and you've got Eric Draven. But there is a really good balance in writing here to give everybody just a little bit more than just a toss off character. You could feel history there with them and a little bit of depth. Glenn, are we off on this at all? Or would you say that they have more depth than say some other villains we've seen in superhero films or comic book movies?
Yeah.
All right. Sorry. Any in particular for you? Would you say that the main villain, like our head guy, really is actually a rather fascinating character?
Yeah, he has actual personality.
Mm-hmm.
He's not just simply there just because I'm evil. That's it. That's not his only. He doesn't just exist just because the villain needed. The hero needed someone to fight. There's actually at least some depth. And yeah, like I said, some personality to his character. He's not just, you know, just cardboard cutout villain number four.
And it is interesting that his character did not exist in the graphic novel, of course. But it wasn't just a toss-off sort of character, that he does give some good drive to the movie that way.
Well, Top Dollar existed.
Well, yeah, but not in that form. Yeah.
He wasn't a death-obsessed, you know. Voodoo priest.
Well, what I love too is, if I remember correctly, I don't think they ever really mention what his name is in the film.
They never say Top Dollar.
They never give his name at all. He's just the main bad guy, you know. And Mark, would you say too that Obar? What would you think of the idea if I said that I feel Obar is making a little bit of commentary on the public's, the pop culture and public culture glorifying criminals with his little speech about how Devil's Night has become a tourist attraction.
Greeting, Devil's Night greeting cards. Yeah, that's a great. Yeah, that whole speech there, that entire scene where the long pan over the table where it's all the money and the drugs and they're all loading guns and everything like that, and it pans up. And he's pretty much just like, no, I'm done with this. And it's that entire scene is fascinating because just talking about the motivations that they have. And he takes this entire grand loop about how he's done with it to loop back around to, no, we're going bigger than ever. It's just sort of head spinning about where that whole scene goes.
It's well, he starts talking like supervillain talk, you know,
yes.
Like, I want a fire that the gods will even, I'm like, dude, this is awesome.
Yeah.
You know,
yes. Dude starts monologuing.
He's monologuing, but he's one of the few, you know, comic book villains that you get that I would love to have seen more of, because this guy is just, you know, regardless of his incestuous relationship with his sister who likes to burn eyeballs.
you need villains like that because, I mean, let's face it, the hero, he's there for revenge. That's not a heroic thing. That's kind of a bad, evil thing to kind of think about. So you need villains that are even more over the top than your hero. So that's, they had to go there. Otherwise, if they would have had somebody that was at on par with Eric, it would have been just like, oh, wow.
And they got a great actor for it, too. I loved him. I mean, I just, you know, he's still, they still get one of those favorite scenes. It's after, you know, the crow is offed everybody but Skank, and Skank is recounting to our head villain what happened. And this one's for you, T-Bird. And he just goes, maybe we should record this and play it back in slow motion.
Yes. Yes.
But the way he delivers it, and that's what I like, the humor in here. I totally, Mark, what'd you think of the humor in here? They work it enough to where it doesn't, it makes you laugh, but it doesn't feel like wah, wah.
Yeah, it's never over the top as far as the little jokes or anything like that. There's little snort moments and stuff like that, but it's not enough to where it breaks the overall mood. There's things where you have to lighten things periodically just because of how dark this movie is. And there's little moments. Oh, it's like where Skank is, the car chase, where he's in the Ford Fiesta, which... which is inherently funny, and he's yelling at the car, damn foreign cars, and he's trying to chase along, and he falls out the door, and there's the door chime at the end of it, just like little elements like that.
Well, never mind the fact he got hit with the thing.
Yes,
I love that whole sequence. Skanks gets hit with this car, and he's laying on the ground, and the guy gets out of the car and goes, son of a bitch, you hit my car.
Yeah.
It starts beating up on him, and he got hit with the car.
Skank had a bad day. He was just having a bad day.
Skank had a really bad day. Oh, man, but he was great. And, all these other side characters, too. We get not so villain, but a great scene. I mean, there's some great scenes in here, and we'll go to our panel in a minute because I want to hear their questions. But one of my favorite favorite segments in here is the scene in Gideon's pawn shop.
Yes.
With Gideon.
Yes. Also, because it is shot for shot from the graphic novel.
Oh, it is.
It is.
Yeah.
It is shot for shot. And it's beautiful.
Yeah. I love that scene, the way it plays out, because. And what's funny is I'm watching it and I go, you know, I know they weren't trying to, but there are just little hints, I swear, in this film where they borrowed a bit from Batman and Batman Returns.
Mr. Gideon. Yeah.
and not in a bad way, but just, you know, like when he walks up to the glass in the door and he looks through the glass. It was almost like the way they had the scene from Catwoman looking through the glass at Shrek department store. I'm looking at it just going, these are pretty cool scenes. But yeah, the whole segment at Gideon's, I think, is just amazing. It's such a great setup. And the Gideon character, Mark, what do you think of Gideon?
Oh, man. It's just, he jumped off the page pretty much. And it just, he fit in so well with how they created that sequence from the graphic novel. Just the perfect slimeball character. And I love how they did give him a little bit more time when he came back and reported to Top Dollar with what was going on. Mm-hmm. I mean, just finishing up that sequence there and showing he was just a guy who never knew when to shut up.
No.
That was just a beautiful scene. His demise.
Yes, and his demise. Oh, for Christ's sake, just die already.
Yeah.
And he gets shot. Paul, how'd you feel about Gideon, and especially the scene in the pawn shop where we get the guitar?
Yeah.
I honestly, the only thing I really remember about the scene was the reference to the Raven poem.
Yeah.
That's the one thing. And if it's been a while, but was this also the scene where Draven shoots the shotgun with rings?
Yes.
Does it happen in there? Okay. Yeah. So that part I do remember. I remember him having a guitar. Does he get it from this scene then?
Yeah. He picks it up as he walks out. Yeah.
And what's great is the music soundtrack works in a guitar riff or whatever you want to call it. I don't know what you call it. I guess it would be a little riff sound when he picks it up, the wah-wah sound. And then you get that again every time he moves the guitar. It's awesome. But that's the scene where he shoots the rigs. And whoever they got to be the stunt guy for him to stand by the building when it blows up. Man, Glenn, that scene with Gideon when it blows up, that stunt guy standing there, I mean, that's an impressive scene, isn't it? Glenn, what do you think of this Gideon segment?
Yeah, that's really well done. The stunt work in this film is very, very good.
Mm-hmm. All of it, not just in that scene, but in general, the fight scenes in that, and they're not over long either, except for, I mean, you know, you do get the shootout when he confronts the entire table of all the mob bosses, which you would expect that scene to be a little bit long. But most of these fights don't carry on for too long, which I kind of appreciated because I was like, okay, because he is a force to be reckoned with. So these Motor City crooks, the gang, you know, haven't really gone up against someone like this before. Yeah. So they've been preying on the weak, if you will. The stunt work I think was good in here as well. I agree. Cole, how about you with these fight scenes in this film? Do you think they were well done? How'd you feel about them?
The fight scenes? Oh, I thought they were fantastic. You know, I think they're definitely cut down. I have the word print it's hard to watch the R-rated version after you've seen the work print because you realize, and rightfully so, that they were trying to cut back on, the harm that these scenes might do to Brandon Lee's legacy, and that they did the right thing, because I'm telling you, when he's on that scene and when he's on that table.
Yeah.
And they all just start shooting at him. It goes on for like fucking 2 minutes straight.
Wow.
You know, I mean, it's just like. And he just, it's like.
So they RoboCop him.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. So I can understand it. On the other hand, you know, watching it tonight on Blu-ray, thank you to my fiance. She'll listen to this in a couple weeks, I'm sure. But thank you for buying me the Blu-ray. But I do notice the cuts. I notice the cuts. You know, I notice the lack of the splatterage. And not just in that shot, in the whole shootout. Everything is cut back, including, like, when he picks up the sword and, you know, he's like, you're all going to die. Which is a wonderful line for the graphic novel that was carried into the film. And they don't really carry through with it in, you know, they did shoot all of that, you know, they did shoot it. It's not in the film, but the movie itself is absolutely perfect. I mean,
I particularly like the final battle. You know, we get
God, is that a beautiful ballet of Gothic artistry.
I was like, wow, this right here is just a goth's dream, like wet
it
dream
is.
Right here.
It really
on
is.
Top of an old gothic church.
Yes.
The guy with a sword with a fucking weather vane. steel weather vane, and the bad guy dies by falling on a demonic statue. With the horns coming through his head.
Yeah.
With Graham Revell doing this. I mean, Graham Revell. Mm. Let's at least give Graham some props. Jesus. Oh, well, that's a gorgeous score, dude.
Yes.
I was going to say that was the next thing I wanted to talk about. Before we get to your guys' questions, was this music in here. Apparently, Obar would listen to a lot of The Cure, and that when he was writing the comic. So apparently, you know, then he approached them and they agreed to doing the original song for it, which apparently they only played live once after the film came out. In like 19 years. Apparently their 2016 tour, they played it more, but they only played it once live. And everybody thinks the soundtrack, and I did. I mean, that was one of the CDs that was constantly on loop in my CD player that I had Velcroed to the top of the dashboard in my Buick, which was attached to a tape deck adapter because I didn't have a CD player in it. And never mind. I MacGyvered a CD player so I could play CD songs in my car. And one of them that was always on play was this soundtrack. But I think people do forget about the score. Mark, what would you say? I know the alternative music that they had in here, or alternative rock is called, is a great score. But what do you think about the score? And I don't think it's talked about enough.
Oh, this score is the score that really got me noticing the orchestral themes in movies, and the way it weaved into the different shots and the scenes. The way I sort of think of it, I call it like ethno-noir. The way he blends the different elements. There's the instruments, the duduk, and the different shakers and percussion. And then there's also the harmon-muted trumpet, and all of those elements, how those sort of disparate elements are blending together to make this, you know, this dark urban landscape that he's making. But then there's the more, goes into the love story elements with the strings and the lush sounds there. This score spans the gamut as far as its sounds and the landscape it covers. And it pulls across the emotion of the different elements of the movie so, so very well, because you can hear, it has themes that's missing in so many movies today, where you have the memorable themes, but just the different, and even when it's like only three or four notes or something like that, you know what was happening on the screen when that particular motif came up. And it's just, it's a lovely score.
Yes. Oh, it's like a character unto itself.
It is. Absolutely. That's a good way of putting it.
So you enjoy the score as well, Glenn?
Oh yeah. This, I can count on one hand the number of movie soundtracks that I own.
Mm-hmm.
And this is on it. So,
nice.
Yeah, when this came out, yeah, this I listened to this all the time. I wore out the CD.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the trumpet in that, because they don't mention Detroit ever in the movie, but there's references to Motor City, and even the cops on their cars say Motor City Police, but it is obviously Detroit.
Mm-hmm. I think the news reporter, where they talk about the tradition, Devil's Night, and they're talking about, I think they mentioned, did they say Detroit there?
Never say Detroit.
No, yeah. But Devil's Night was my understanding, because I looked into it later on, was actually a thing in Detroit
that
occurred before Halloween, was people setting just things ablaze. Right. But what I dug about this score, and now that you mentioned the trumpet, is it had a bit of a jazzy feel at times, which adds to that urban feel.
It's that noir sort of feel to it. It's that the dark, or it's the urban landscape sort of thing, and it comes across with that, with just that little motif. That's all it was needed to give that flavor. And this is the score that gave me the idea and that feeling that you can use just a little bit of a sound. That's all you need, just a little sprinkling of it. And you get that idea across. Mm-hmm. You don't need to be heavy-handed with it. And that's something I still have to learn at times. You don't have to be heavy-handed with things. you can just put a little bit of something in, and that's the flavoring, and that's all you need.
Well, and I think that sums up this film because it does that throughout. It doesn't get heavy-handed, but we did a different. We kicked off our superhero month with the Phantom, and I mentioned on how very subtle, almost non-existent, it felt that he had powers with animals. Here again, we have a guy with a power with animal, and you don't overuse it enough, but you get enough to get the idea that okay, there's something more going on here with the crow rather than it just being a really awesome view. And in the music too, you get just enough. Paul, how about you with the music in this score and the idea that maybe it fits the whole overall approach of this movie where they give you just enough, but they don't really overuse anything.
Everything about this film has that. It's we've talked about this with special effects. We talked about it with the acting. We talked about it, the story. So again, the music has to follow that same pattern. Otherwise it would stand out in a good way. You know, it stand out in a bad way. So yes, in this case, less is best.
Less mm-hmm. is best. Yeah, Cole, you mentioned you saw the work print and how you had the longer things, but would you say, within your experience of being the filmmaker and editor and that it's not necessarily a bad thing, and the approach of just giving you enough really carries out through all the elements in this film?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think it is a perfect film. Mm-hmm. I think, without getting too personal, and I'm about to, I think there's a level of commitment that happened between the crew in a lot of scenes that compose probably a fourth of the movie. They were done after their lead had passed on. And this is a thing that, and I've lost friends over this. I mean, I love The Crow. The Crow will always be my favorite movie. This will probably be the last time I ever speak publicly about The Crow. It really will be, because I can only lose so many friends over, are you a Brandon Lee fan or are you a Crow fan? And I'm fucking sick of dealing with, quite honestly. I don't give a shit where those people stand. The Crow changed my life. Mm-hmm. It's a perfect film. They dealt with this tragedy the only way they could. And a lot of the best scenes of this movie, and I'm sorry to anybody who doesn't agree with this, a lot of the best scenes of this movie, they don't have Brandon Lee in them.
No.
They don't. The scene of Eric putting on his makeup, the scenes of Eric jumping over the rooftops, T-Bird's death. Brandon Lee I'm just saying, this is a work of art. You've got to acknowledge this as that. And when people come down on the remake, and I don't agree with a remake, I could give a fuck about a remake.
Well, the remake's not happening.
It will never happen. It's been up and down so many times. All I'm saying is that this original film was a work of a bunch of people who are like, Jesus Christ, are we going to do this or are we not? Well, you know what? We're going to do this because Brandon really would have wanted us to.
Right.
So they fucking finished it. Mm-hmm. And it's not his tombstone. You know, what really bums me out is that quote that is not his, which is, you guys can look it up, because we do not know when we will die. We get to think of life as an inexhaustible well. That's not Brandon's quote. And apparently that's on his tombstone. I would just like to say that it's good to keep things in perspective and realize that this is Brandon's last film. And that's all right. That's okay. It's okay that this is Brandon's last film. It's also okay that this might be the last Crow film that is a classic. All of that is okay. We can all coexist and acknowledge the fact that there will never be a Crow film as good as this again. And maybe they shouldn't fucking try. Cole has some words about that.
Just as a side note, I went to the Madison Comic Con about 3 years ago, and then I realized why I don't usually go to conventions. But what was really cool is they did a showing of The Crow with James O'Barr there. And James did a Q&A thing before they played the movie, and one of the things he brought up was the remake, because people asked, because they were talking about it back then. And Hollywood, the way it is, when they sign someone, when they get someone, since it's union and that, they already commit to some money to the people who sign on to be in that role, and if the time period expires, those people still get money. He mentioned on how much money they had already spent, and not a single thing was done with the remake yet, and it was more than the budget of the original film. Because they signed, I forgot who first for the remake, because it's been in production hell for like ever. So they signed the one person for a lead. That contract expired, but they had to pay him. Then they signed another person. That contract expired. I think at the time, and this was 3 years ago, they had spent close to $20 million and not shot in a single frame, not written. That's Hollywood for you. But so just to give you a bit of perspective on remakes there, Cole, so I don't think you're going to see it anytime soon.
No, sir. Yes, sir.
No, but I just say that you're right about that. There is the outrage that you get nowadays that you probably would have gotten back then. And as far as the sequels go, yeah, I'll agree with you there that this original Crow, but you know, it makes you wonder though, would they have ever really been able to justify a sequel, or set it up for one had Brandon Lee not passed away?
He was signed for three. He was signed for two other sequels.
Oh, he was okay.
Yeah, he. As far as I know, I only have Robert Zuckerman's book.
Sure.
So I can't. You know, I don't have any more knowledge than anybody else. But apparently, they were gonna follow it up, which was Weinstein's whole. You know, well, we were.
I believe that's his exact quote. I think I read that somewhere where it actually says quote unquote. That was Weinstein's actual quote, folks. Thank you, Cole, for that.
Sorry, brother.
No, I'm just kidding. So we're going to go down the aisle here. I want to see if we haven't touched on a topic yet, if our panel here has something that they'd like to bring to the table. So, Paul, we're going to start with you. You always have the most interesting questions. Have not talked about it yet. Do you have a topic or subject that you'd like us to discuss?
We covered the music thing, but I have a different question that I had ready just in case, because I knew the music would be a big thing that we would talk about. My question is, how does Brandon Lee's untimely death affect the outcome of this film?
Nice. I like that. Glenn, what do you say?
I mean, they had to get creative in the way that they shot some of their scenes, obviously. Something they did incredibly well. I mean, what was it? The scene where he, after he comes out of the grave, and he walks back, you know, he walks through the alley in the rain and everything, and you see him in the doorway, and they actually had to digitally compose all of that. I don't know how much it obviously it changed the way that they knew they weren't making any more, at least not with him. Mm-hmm. And I know it had serious effect on several of the cast members, especially what was his name?
Michael Madsen.
Michael Madsen. Yeah, I mean, he didn't act for like over a year after this because he was so shaken up over it. So
it fucked up his life.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, it had effects. I mean, you wonder, like, what was morale like on that set?
Yeah,
it was all. Well, they had a therapist on the set for the reshoots, not to overcome anybody's. I didn't mean to step in. I'm just saying
they had a. But I mean, even that. I mean, even with a therapist, I'm like, you know.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's tough, especially with films, because everybody's just, you commit to this thing, and then, holy crap, this happens. Mm-hmm. And, yeah. Mark, how about you? How do you think the death of Brandon Lee affected the outcome of this film, or the acceptance, too?
Well, I think it was one of those things that helped the marketing of it. It's when there was a death associated with it. And so I think it probably gave it a little bit more attention than it probably would have otherwise. Mm-hmm. And of course, there is also the, I don't know if you want to say mystique associated with that when someone died in the production of making a movie. But I think it made more people give a look to it than otherwise would have. Mm-hmm. Which is ultimately to its benefit, because I think it would have been easy for this movie to vanish a little bit more. Just because it just, early 90s comic book movie, wouldn't have gotten the attention that it did. And I think that it did help it in that way.
And Cole, how about you? How do you feel? Do you think, it impacted, or the acceptability, or and went out with the Crow, the death of Brandon Lee, how it affected this?
Oh, this movie would have done just fine without Brandon Lee dying. This movie would have been a huge hit without Brandon Lee dying. Rapid Fire did okay, but that's just because it was just okay. I think that this movie, The Crow, was on its way to being a huge hit. I will give people this, and I used to say it when I was younger. Alex Proyas might have learned to shoot shit differently and not quite so obviously. You know what I mean? And learned a more creative way of developing scenes. But fucking, this movie would have been way, way better if Brandon Lee had been in it. Had he been allowed to finish it. The Crow would have gone on to be a far more successful phenomenon. You can scratch out City of Angels, you know, Salvation, Wicked Prayer. Brandon Lee was signed on to a 3-picture deal. And I firmly believe that all those scenes, him putting on the makeup, him killing T-Bird, which was, you know, they put footage of him in Gideon's room and just like stuck his face in there during that scene right before he lights the big fiery bird.
Yeah.
I very firmly believe this would have been a much better film had Brandon Lee been alive. That's my take on it.
Thanks. Paul, to answer your own question?
To answer my own question, I would say that the film would not have been as condensed as it was. I think this film, I hate to say it, but is better for his death, because it forced them to do things that they would not normally have done. We've commented on how this film was so minimalistic, but it was because they're kind of forced to. They couldn't do much more on the love scenes. They couldn't do reshoots. Well, they did, but you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if he would have been in the film, the character focus would have been on his character, and I think we wouldn't have focused as much on all the other characters. And we seem to have, you know, in the course of this discussion, said that they gave a lot of great balance by introducing these characters, and I think that it would have been a much different film. And I honestly think it would have been a worse film.
Hmm.
Oh, Jesus Christ!
I know.
Look out! Cole's gonna reach through the screen and
no, not at all.
I throw something at you, Paul.
No, he can. He can. It's just
no, of course not.
And I agree with Cole for his reasoning too. But I'm just, you know, for just it's no,
I get what you're saying. I get what you're saying. It actually made them have to cut some corners in that, and actually, it makes it for a faster-paced film, that's for sure. And I agree that what they had to do actually, I think, may have helped the film. I think it would have also been fine either way, but I think the death of Brandon Lee, unfortunately, did bring it up to the forefront because superhero films were still, people were kind of leery because outside of Superman, the only other bar they had to compare it to was Batman. So I could have easily seen people, instead of focusing on the actual film, if had it come out and Brandon Lee was still alive and everything and there wasn't controversy, going, oh man, this is a Batman ripoff. you know, which some people still may say. But I think people approached it differently specifically because of Brandon Lee's death, not just the filmmakers, but people watching it. And, you know, I think it helped solidify the film a little more. And as it was mentioned by one of the other panels here, it got more eyes on it, I think, that may have. Though I agree with Cole, it probably would still have done fine. But I don't think it would have had quite the status where it is today. With it, because it has that extra punch. It's just like Twilight Zone movie. Let's face it, you know, the Twilight Zone movie has that curse with it, which adds just a little extra flavor to the film. And among cinephiles, they eat that stuff up. So, you know what I mean? So,
I would say there are two very different things, though. I really would. I would say the death of Brandon Lee and the Twilight Zone movie.
Well, no,
perhaps worlds apart. Perhaps.
Well, no, I'm not saying that the Twilight Zone movie was like a perfect crow. What I was mostly bringing up is the fact of how it's received by the public or perceived with the public, or how it's, you know, they approach the film when they see it with that in mind versus it just being another film.
Roger, but he is in one small portion of the film. You know what I mean? It's in the opening of the film, which involves four separate stories as opposed to a lead character who, you know, who is in an hour and 42 minutes.
Yes, but I it's not so much the writing of the character I'm mentioning, Cole, as much as the fact of just the idea of someone passing away on a film set and bringing that into the tension and how people approach watching the film. Versus whether or not it's a main character or whatnot, you get that today with certain stunt people who you've learned suddenly passed away on a set. Suddenly, some people approach the film a little bit differently, knowing there was this tragedy on set versus just going to a film where there was no tragedy. I'm just saying it does affect a public, I think, approach.
Oh, we're referring to box office numbers.
I'm talking about how the audience receives and approaches a film.
Roger.
I'm saying think The Crow, if Brandon Lee's passing hadn't happened with The Crow, while it still would have been good, I don't think it would have had that little extra level of flavor, of approach, of appreciation, of view by an audience, the public audience especially, if that didn't happen. I'm not saying it doesn't make it a poorer film. I'm just saying...
Oh, Roger, yeah.
It sticks in history a lot more because of that. And so
it sticks in history, but he was... Rapid Fire was a fairly moderate hit.
Yeah.
And I think The Crow would have been a bigger hit.
Yes, it would.
Because of his charisma. He might have even been a bigger hit.
It would have been a bigger hit. No, I agree with it being a hit. I'm just saying its staying power to this day, I think, having that unfortunate history to it puts it a little bit more than just another 90s superhero film.
Roger.
Is where I'm coming from with that.
Agreed.
You know, so... Excellent question, as always, Paul. Mark, how about you? Do you have something you didn't cover yet that you may want to talk about quick?
The one thing that always jumps out to me, because I was talking about how I always compare and contrast between the movie and the graphic novel. And the one thing that I sort of miss from the graphic novel is the conversation that Eric has with Fun Boy. Mm-hmm. And there's the whole idea there where Fun Boy is a monster and he knows it. Mm-hmm. And the whole, the depth into his character a little bit more. And it's almost like a moment of redemption in a way for him. And it's sort of like how Eric just kills Fun Boy in the movie. Mm-hmm. But there's this little talk and almost a moment of understand, not even necessarily understanding, but just like peering into the abyss of what was happening in the minds of these villains. And I understand that that's the sort of thing that you can't do in an hour 40 minute movie.
Yeah.
But that conversation they had, and the one line where Funboy is saying, and you know, he's ODing on his morphine and says, when you find those guys, kill them slow. And then Eric goes off to do his business. But I just find that it's the whole thing of the simplifying and streamlining. But I did think I think of it as redemption in a way. Mm-hmm. But that scene always sticks out. I mean, I just think it's one of those themes of that graphic novel in a way. So no, just a comment. No real question.
Okay,
or anything
sure.
Like that.
No, it's okay.
Just get a rabble off here.
No, it's okay. Though I did enjoy the scene in the movie, which comes up with one of those moments where there's just enough humor where you're just going, oh my God. But it felt natural for his character.
Mm-hmm.
I do like the scene with Funboy in there. And plus you get that actually really great scene after he throws Funboy in the shower to wake him up.
And actually that scene was somewhat accurate as well. Mm-hmm. Some of the shots in there. Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's actually one of my favorite bits. It's one of those unexpected bits because here you guy who's a vigilante, he's coming back, he's on revenge. You have the mom of the little girl. And,
yes, yes.
And,
mm-hmm.
You know, all of a sudden, here he is, he's ready to kill this guy. He wakes him up to kill him.
Yeah.
Which I'm like, damn, that's cold right there.
Yeah.
But he grabs her arm, pushes the morphine out, and says,
mother is the word for God on the lips of children. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, oh, damn.
Yes. Like, yes.
It shows the power of just one line and one scene. And I'm like sitting there going, that's awesome. And you don't expect it in this film where up until this point, you've just been seeing him kick everybody's ass.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden he's turning this mom around. And it's like, wow. Okay. We got an extra element in here.
Mm-hmm.
So. Yeah, I dig the Funboy scene in the movie.
The following scene where the mother is trying to be really like the best mom in the world to Sarah afterwards was just, that was even more amazing to me. It was the fact that he did kind of scare her and she was willing to do it, and then she was like, oh, I can't do this. I'm not. This doesn't work for me. I tried. Just, oh.
Yeah. And while I'm not too familiar with the scene in the comic with the fun boy, it still makes for a great scene in the film.
Yes.
Well, that's not in the comic.
Right. No, I understand. Well, no, that's what I mean is even though it's not the way the scene plays out in the comic, I still think they set it up well. And it sounds like, you know, they're trying to at least go for a little bit of the spirit of that scene. Glenn, how about you? The scene in fun boy in the movie versus in the comic. Did you like the scene with fun boy all right in the movie?
It's fine in the movie, but it's not the comic.
Word.
But I didn't watch that scene and go, oh, that was shit.
Yeah.
You didn't pull an internet, you mean?
No. I did not instantly rush to my computer and rage, which would have been really weird because it would have taken a long time.
That was dial-up Mosaic.
Yeah.
You have to
Glenn, how do you think people would react to this movie now? Like,
oh my God, they'd be...
They would be so irate.
Oh my God, they would be going fucking nuts.
They would.
Yeah.
The director would be like forced off social media.
Yes, of course. of course.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it'd be.
This is nothing like the comic book. They are nothing alike. They're not.
But compared to what one producer wanted to do.
Yes, I'm glad you're
talking about
it,
Michael.
Cole.
Yes,
Michael Jackson. Glenn.
Michael Jackson and doing this as a musical. which is actually the thing I was going to bring up.
Go ahead, yes. Go for it. Yes,
it just segues into it perfectly. Yes, could you imagine if that producer had gotten his wish?
And
it was Crow the Musical with Michael Jackson, playing Eric as the Crow.
Yes, and that was a legitimate.
It was.
Brought that up. Michael Jackson. And who was the director? I can't.
Julian.
Julian Temple, right?
Julian Temple, I think, yeah.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Wow. Mark, you're the music guy. Can you see The Crow as a musical with Michael Jackson pulling a moonwalker?
I'm sorry. I'm I need a moment.
These are facts, I swear to God.
He mentions it several times. Once in an interview and once, I think, on the commentary for The Crow 2.
Yes.
He's like, why would you even buy this if you're going to change absolutely everything about it?
I just get the image
of kind of
you're
anyways,
about to
but...
die. Hee hee. And that's my other question. Like, would this film even succeed nowadays? I mean, it's so different from the source material, and I love it. It's my favorite film of all time, although I just saw, Annihilation, which I also
love. But so it would be one of two things today. Is it would depend on if they went with a cast of relative nobodies, I think it could succeed in that it would make money. But
Roger.
They probably wouldn't do that. They would load this up and blow $50 million just on the cast.
Yeah.
Such bloated effects budgets. And depending on who did it, I mean, if it was Michael Bay, it would just be a 2-hour, with the Crow just like shooting fireballs out of his ass or something.
Well, that happened in City of Angels anyway.
Yeah,
They blew up palm trees.
So, although maybe if they shot it now, they could actually use crows instead of ravens.
Though his name was Eric Draven, so it was more fitting, I thought. Yeah, what were you going to say, Paul?
Those weren't crows.
But the themes are still universal. So I think they could still get across a film that meets the needs thematically. Of course, like you guys said, it's going to be overbloated. It's going to be the things that we love about this film would not be in a modern take of it, but the themes will still be there. At least I hope.
James Gunn could do it.
Yeah.
James Gunn.
Wow, James Gunn, The Crow?
Actually, the whole crew that was behind, in all honesty, now don't you guys hit me. I know you're all huge fans, but the crew behind Deadpool, if they could pull this off, because they were the ones when they made the original Deadpool, they said they didn't want a larger budget because they wanted to work with a smaller one to do the best they could. And I think they even did that with Deadpool 2 in some respects. So, I think they could maybe pull it off too. And not make it as a comedy, make a serious piece. But I think Tim Miller, the director, and I think they could pull it off as well. But very few would be able to. And as far as how it would be received today, yeah, I think there'd be a lot of fanboy keyboards on fire. Because people couldn't type.
Well, I'm just curious about the whole Jesus Christ. I mean, the Me Too movement and the rave scene in the novel, and James O'Barr talking about we're going to do this exactly like my book. It just doesn't seem like the right time to do it. It really doesn't. I personally don't want to see that scene on screen. And I'm a hardcore Crow fan. I don't want to see Shelley being raped by 5-6 fucking dudes on crack.
No,
so
they...
I don't know what they're necessarily going for, but it might be best to just avoid a remake. Honestly.
Yeah, and this original film, I think we all agree that those who don't know anything about The Crow would probably love it as I did, but those who know a lot about The Crow, there'd be fanboy rage all over the place. Your internet just be exploding all over the place. This thing's nothing like the comic. Oh my God, they ruined my childhood. They literally changed the comic when they made this movie. All those old issues that I have that are printed suddenly changed because they didn't do The Crow right live action style.
How many of those people would actually have the actual comics? Rather, they looked up the you know, Google. They Googled everything about the comic books, and that's their extent of it.
I torrented the electronic copy. There's no way I'm going to buy the original. Exactly. I'm just going to torrent the comic book digital copy. No, just kidding. So all great stuff, guys. I just want to mention, because we didn't really talk about him too much tonight, I have to. I think this is one of, for my, I guess, comment for the night, and maybe topic is Ernie Hudson. This is one of, I think, this was a great role for him. He really makes the most of this cop role. He doesn't get a huge amount of scenes, but when we do see him, I love him in this. I've always loved Ernie Hudson anyway. I think he's a fantastic actor. But in this film, he really has some great just scenes and moments in here, especially when he and Eric are in his apartment. Mark, what'd you think about Ernie Hudson in this film?
Oh, he was a great presence through the entire movie. Absolutely. I don't know. Yeah, words sort of, it just enjoyable and just a sort of a grounding presence through the entire thing.
He is. He's the voice. He's definitely the voice of the audience.
Yeah, this. Yeah.
He didn't
do that walking against the wind. Shit, I hate that.
A whole bunch of people suddenly come walking in looking like a mime from hell.
Yeah.
Which makes me wonder if they even gave him any script. They said, okay, Ernie, here we go.
Yeah.
At least he didn't do that walking against the wind shit. I hate that shit. Yeah. And they even gave his character some depth. Paul, what'd you think of Ernie Hudson in this film?
I thought he did the character justice. He did a really good job with it. And I think the character itself is hugely important to the story. Because, you know, first of all, it gives kind of that bookend thing. He was important at the beginning, is important at the end. Because if it wasn't for his character, I don't think he would, because he actually did the noble thing. He's the hero, in my mind, of the story. He stuck around and he watched, you know, all that suffering. And it was that pain that he witnessed that Eric was able to use at the end. And I loved that. I loved how that worked its way into the story. And it made his character that much more like thumbs up for me, was the fact that they allowed his character to make such a huge impact in the film.
Yeah, he actually gives our hero, or the crow, yeah. He gives him the weapon. And you're right, he does actually become kind of the hero on that. Cole, how about you with Ernie Hudson? Would you say that he's kind of actually the hero of the movie?
I think that he does what he needs to do, which is support Eric Draven's character. Mm-hmm. Eric Draven's character is the centerpiece. It is, you know, the very center stable of the story. Mm-hmm. And everybody sort of kind of revolves around that and tries to be funny or tries to be romantic or tries to be... I remember when Trent Reznor first saw the film, he said, well, Jesus, you know, they gave my song a prominent position. Yeah. You know, Brandon's jumping across the rooftops. And actually, that isn't even Brandon. Yeah. I mean, it Brandon is the stable of this fucking movie. Mm-hmm. And if anything works in this movie, it is because of Brandon Lee.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically my final word on that.
Glenn, how about you with Ernie Hudson in this? Did you like him in this role?
I like Ernie Hudson in every role.
Me too. Same here.
Even Ghostbusters 2?
I don't blame him for that movie.
And on that note,
it's like, I don't blame the sun for my sunburn. That was my own dumb fault.
The earth is flat, Glenn. Damn it.
What?
Sure.
Okay. And on that note, I think we're going to end our crow discussion tonight. As you can tell, we've all loved it. If you grew up, if you were high school to college age in the 90s, this was one of those films that was on probably play quite a bit, whether it was music or the movie. As I'm told someone, this is one of those films for me where I would flip through the channels, you know, back on, you know, with cable and that back in the day when you didn't have so many streaming channels, but I'd flip through the channels and if The Crow was on, that was it. I stopped channel surfing because I'm like, oh, Crow's on. All right.
You know? Nice, nice.
You know, so it's one of those films that I watched it again and I'm like, wow, I still have a lot of this film remembered. It's stuck with me for a long time. And I think it's a comic book film, you know, just as comic book films were still feeling their way. This film not only, I think, brought to light that there were other heroes out in the world that didn't have the name Marvel or DC attached to them, though it was Dark Horse, which is, yes, I know, technically a branch of DC. Thank you, fanboys. Okay, shut up. But still, Dark Horse and the graphic novels were coming up big in the 90s. You know, the grittier stuff and that. So, yeah. I hope you enjoyed our conversation and our ramblings about The Crow. We could go on and on about this film, but we won't. Instead, now we are going to give you a chance to hear where you can find these fine folks' stuff when they aren't here discussing the finer things in life. So, Cole, where can they find you at?
You can find me at Shadows and Lovers Productions on Facebook. I also have a film on Amazon, The Last Great Horror Movie. If you're feeling frisky, seek it out. And you can always find me on the Spoiler Room. So thank you, Mark.
You bet. Thanks for joining us. I knew you would want to be in on this episode. Great discussion. Thank you. Glenn, the BFD, where can they find you at?
You can find me at Lost Lovers. Wait, no, I'm sorry. you can find me on YouTube with the B-Movie Bunker and Guy in a Bunker Productions, although I haven't done shit on there all year. Take that, lethargy. living up to sloth. You can also find me on gncast.com with the Adventure Party, which is the gaming tabletop podcast that I actually do semi-regularly when my co-host is not getting married.
Jeez.
Yeah, that's fine. That's good for him. I'm happy. I think you should go up to see his point and get drunk.
There you go.
And you can also just find me on Facebook or on Twitter with @guyinabunker.
Awesome. Mark, pimp your stuff, man.
Oh, wow. Okay. I got to put on my special shoes for that first. Find me at centralbatterymusicworks.com. That's where I have my orchestral works, and the latest project I've been working on is Spaces Between, which is my orchestral rock project with Gretel Stock Coverman, and that's on soundcloud.com at spaces-between.
Nice. And Paul, Mr. Salzer.
Wow. Well, you can find me a year from now with my spirit crow, Mr. Poe. actually, no. You can find me on the Facebook again. Oh, Face Jerks. Film Jerks on Facebook at www.facebook.com/groups/filmjerks.
And his group will be free as well, folks. I'm assuming. I don't think he'll be charging you $4.99 to access the group. Sorry, I just saw a headline where they said that groups and Facebook can now start charging if they want for people to have access to them. And I'm like, yeah, that's going to go over well.
Let's monetize things.
Yes, let's monetize things. And you can find links for all these fine folks on specialmarkproductions.com website. I appreciate them taking the time. We went a little extra long tonight. I figured we would because of the movie we were talking about. And also, just so you folks know, yes, The Crow proves that you can make a dark film with people dressed up like goths, and you can have it be not nihilistic. Yes, that's right. I know. It's a novel concept. But trust me, they do it. It's not nihilistic. It actually has a happy ending. Oh, my God. Yet the guy, if you look at the cover, you'd go, oh, my God, that's what... Anyway. Yes. So seek out The Crow. Hope you enjoyed our listen, our talk. And now, let's just say, fire it up and send this episode on its way. Ready, guys?
Fire it up!
Fire.
Hey, all my friends out there looking for more Spoiler Room goodness? Then why don't you check out our brand new Patreon page, patreon.com/specialmarkproductions, where you can get access to exclusive Spoiler Room episodes and a whole lot more. You can also find us on Facebook groups at SMPRD and on to Twitter at Special Mark Pro. Let your voice be heard and let us know what you would like to see in the Spoiler Room, as well as just how we're doing in general. We appreciate your support, and remember, in the Spoiler Room, the conversation is fresh, but we do spoil the movies.